All right. Happy Sunday. Welcome to Kauai Death Cafe. You're in studio with Susan and Jenna. How you doing, Susan?
I'm good. How are you doing, Jenna?
I'm doing good. So we're nestled in. We're going to listen to sort of a long part of a discussion today from Stephen Jenkinson, Making Meaning in the End of Our Days. It's a two-part series, and we thought we'd listen to part one today. And while we're doing that, we're going to be making Tibetan prayer flags.
We're making Hawaiian prayer flags.
Hawaiian prayer flags.
Based on the Tibetan concept. They, Tibetans made prayer flags, which they had their prayers on, and they strung up all over the land with the idea that the wind would blow the prayers into the world. And I thought it was just such a beautiful concept, but I didn't speak Tibetan, so I didn't know what the prayers were, and I decided to make my own little squares and have everybody I know, including me, make a prayer that we can string up in our own world and send our prayers out. So Jenna and I are going to be doing that while we're listening to Stephen Jenkinson. And I have a whole tree now filled with prayers from everybody who comes to my house has to make a prayer flag. Anyway, it's a beautiful concept, and it's better for me in English.
I like it. I came over to your house the other day, and I saw them, and they look good. You got them really high up in the tree.
Yes, as high as we could get them.
Yeah. And then I was watching a program on YouTube, and I saw the prayer flags in Nepal, and they just had gobs and gobs and flags on top of flags on top of flags. And
that's what I'm aiming for all over my property, to just have flags praying for peace and love and all the wonderful things that we want in this world. That prayer flags is about all I can do. I have no more power to do anything else, so I'm just going to send out prayers.
I think it's a good place to stop. I think that's okay. I like that. I think that's
the
good.
The last chapter.
So we've got this clip with Stephen Jenkinson, and he's in Nevada City, and he's being interviewed by someone, and she's asking some questions. And he is the author of the book Die Wise. Not Die Wisely. He wanted to call it Die Wisely, but then he decided not to, and he called it Die Wise.
He actually gives an explanation of how he meant it to be phrased. He's also has a Harvard degree in divinity, a doctorate degree in divinity from Harvard. He worked for a very long time at some hospital on the East Coast, where he was the one in charge with, you know, helping people through this process. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, he is the newest, most progressive voice that we have out there addressing death and the medical profession and alternatives to the old way of thinking about it. I think he's incredibly admirable and incredibly smart. So I hope you guys enjoy him as much as I did.
Susan gave me the book because I think she started reading it and then went, I'm not reading this. It's incredibly, the book that he wrote.
Yeah, I read it.
Did you read it?
Of course.
It was, I started reading it and I had to stop. I'm like, this is, it's hard read. There's a lot of words. The book is like weighs a pound.
And he does go off on tangents. I mean, he's not the easiest person to read. That's why I'm finding these two interviews on YouTube. Mm-hmm. I think it's very clear.
It's profound. I mean, it really is. I the reason I couldn't read it was because I just wasn't ready. Because you really had to.
It's hard to read.
You really had to put undivided attention towards it. Plus, get a notebook. Plus, get highlighters. Plus, you know, yeah. Because you wanted to be able to digest it. It's really good information. So
that's why these little YouTubes can tell you what you need to know without reading the book.
Exactly. Well, and then now after seeing a few of them and knowing him a little bit better, I'm much more intrigued in reading the book, you know. Mm-hmm. because I agree. I think he's got some really profound insight. So without further ado, here is Stephen Jenkinson talking about the meaning of the ending of days, part one, on YouTube. You guys enjoy.
Gamble for more time. You roll the knuckle bones of your fate, known as chemo and radiation, or maybe operations. And you almost certainly will gain the more time that you're bargaining for. Nobody dies that I saw, really, as a consequence of the bargain. Like things going horribly wrong on the table and like that. So people do enter into the more time, and it bears no resemblance to the more time that they were bargaining for.
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. My guest today is Stephen Jenkinson, who comes to us from Canada. Stephen is a farmer, activist, teacher, and the author of Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. Stephen is the subject of the film, documentary film Grief Walker, and is the founder of the Orphan Wisdom School in Canada. Thank you for joining me
today, Stephen.
You know, you've worked for decades in palliative care. You've seen a lot of folks dying and the people who care for them. I have two questions for you, which could go forever. One is, what makes dying so hard in our time? Let's touch on that. Why is it so hard in this culture? And what can we do differently?
That's it? Okay.
We have 3 hours.
Let's start with the easy stuff first. Well, let me say as a caveat at the beginning that you know, what I saw and learned and was to some degree disfigured by, you could say, as well as informed by, was in a very particular place and time, not even in this country. I wouldn't even generalize across the country I'm from, never mind across borders and cultures and all the rest. So it's just important to say that. So if anybody who's listening or watching this finds something that's familiar or sadly familiar, then that's because they've translated what I'm saying, not because I assume that this is across the board true everywhere for all time, okay?
Yes.
That's the important thing, first of all. So there's some humility built into all of this from my end. How did it get like it is? Well, first of all, I have to articulate a little bit what I saw. And what I saw is, I worked in a medical environment that is as high-tech as you can imagine. As high-tech as probably as available in North America in any urban setting anywhere. And that doesn't qualify for anything more than to have been a kind of ragged witness, almost involuntarily, to what has become of caring for dying people. And it's... the palliative care system, if I could characterize it that way, is principally a medical system. And if anybody tells you otherwise, it's because they haven't been there. That's not an evil thing to acknowledge, but medical means primarily technologically driven.
Okay.
It does not mean gentle Jesus, meek and mild, you know, with a long eyelash donkey. It's very... It's very driven proposition. And what drives it is the ongoing innovation. That innovation has a kind of creed by which it itself grows and proliferates and by which it insinuates itself into the care of people, healthcare system. And that creed is like 10 commandments rolled into one. And when I say it, it won't strike you as odd at all, though it might strike you as deeply flawed, but not odd at all. As best as I could figure it out, it's something in the order of, if you can, you should. If you can, you should.
When I read that in your book, it was like, it reverberated.
Yeah.
And I realized the hope for the next chemo that will be improved, or the next best drug, or the next best intervention, any last straw. that we grasp to keep somebody alive.
Yeah, and let's say it, that it's not a conspiracy foisted upon dying people who are otherwise unwilling. I mean, they're asking for it.
I can get that.
So, so everybody's involved. To a certain degree, you could say a few people might benefit, at least financially, more so in this country than the country I'm from. But suffice to say that even the people who are nominally benefiting from this mania will themselves be set upon by the same mania. So there's no upside to this arrangement for anybody. That's an important note to strike.
No upside.
There's no upside for if you can, you should. No. Because, see, if you, the way I say it, it sounds like a, you know, some kind of quasi-religious commandment that, quote, nobody would agree to.
Right.
Well, because I've said it in a way that it can be observable, when you actually see it happening, it doesn't sound like that at all. It sounds like this. Now, we have 45 minutes. I'm the oncologist and you're not. And I'm going to tell you, in the first 3 minutes that we're together, what we can't do anything about. Mm. That's called your prognosis.
Okay.
Your terminal prognosis. And we have 42 minutes left. You know what we're going to do with it? We're going to talk about what we can do, about what we can't do anything about. You see? And that's the arrangement.
So in a sense, it's an illusion, but you can live longer.
You almost guaranteed you would live longer than you would have done had we not submitted you and you submitted yourself to any kind of treatment regime whatsoever. It's important to say that every palliative care referral that I got, that person was already in the midst of the more time that they were still waiting for. Now there's the mystery, see? Because the idea that the more time actually kicks in at a, on a given day, let's say, is true, but everybody misses the day and the month. At the very least, if not the year, you see.
When they are being granted more time because of the technology. Because they're still hoping that this will turn things around.
They're still hoping for more time.
They're hoping for more time.
So what do you do in the more time that's granted you with your, when you're at the, quote, end of your life? And the answer is, hope you're not at the end of your life.
That's right.
There's very few people who hope they are until the kind of tumbleweed of symptoms so overwhelms any other instinct or preference or plea or attachment that they might have. And here's a dirty little secret. As much as that conglomeration of symptoms does that to dying people, the people who are in the death trade as workers, which I was, are not very secretly hoping that that very thing happens. Why? Because in a culture that doesn't believe in dying at all, which I'm a product of, okay, if you say so.
Of course.
Okay, of course, of course. It's likely that in a culture like this that doesn't believe in dying, especially when it's happening, what are the options available to you as a dying person? Mm-hmm. How are you obliged to see and understand yourself during the course of your dying time? Do you know there's no diagnosis for insurance purposes called dying?
Really?
I'm told that's true in this country. It's certainly true at home. What apparently it's called here is, and you have to enter this in the form, diagnosis is failure to thrive. Now, take the tone of the word failure and try to understand yourself in those terms as a dying person. What are you failing to do?
I mean, it's a natural person. Thing for all of us.
I'd be careful with the word natural. It's, there's a degree of inevitability that seems to gather around it. Even this, as we speak, is in suspended animation. There is no givenness to your dying anymore. I'll give you an example. There was a time within, certainly this was true during your lifetime, that people had a sense, could have had a sense, that they were in what was called, what would have been called their time, that there's such a thing as your time to die. And how do we decide it's your time to die? Well, the signs, which is a matter of saying that anybody who's working in the business, and families and patients themselves, are obliged to be governed by the signs, to be servants to the signs.
That's what's going on with the body or the mind.
The way things are now, that every one of these signs is negotiable. I mean, to a certain point, obviously. But every one of these things is debatable, because the technology is such that these signs are not in and of themselves things to be obeyed. They are limits to be challenged. They are conditions to be thwarted, or at least to be extended. You see. Now, you may or may not know this word. It doesn't come up in polite chatter. The adjective is iatrogenic. It's a technical term, more from the medical field, and it means something like a malady inadvertently caused by a cure. That is fundamentally palliative care now. It's an iatrogenic nightmare from which no one seems quite to awaken. And the form of it, the structure of it, the architecture is this. You gamble for more time. You roll the knuckle bones of your fate, known as chemo and radiation, or maybe operations. And you almost certainly will gain the more time that you're bargaining for.
Aloha and welcome back to the Kauai Death Cafe. We've been listening to an interview with Stephen Jenkinson. He's a palliative care doctor and author out of Canada. And he's got a pretty interesting outlook on death and dying and palliative care, diagnosis, et cetera, et cetera. He was just touching on the signs of dying, and he doesn't really go into what those signs are, but just this morning I was cleaning out my purse, and I had this flyer that I picked up at a hospital or something somewhere, and it just says, "Is it time for hospice? Checklist, 10 signs." So sign number one is a physician has given you a limited life expectancy of 6 months or less. Number two, severe hospitalizations or visits to the emergency room over the last 6 months. Number three, increased medication for physical pain. Number four, several falls within the last 6 months. Number five, frequent phone calls to a physician's office. Number six, a majority of the day is spent in bed or in a chair. Number seven, assistance is required with two or more of the following: getting out of bed, bath, or dressing. Number eight, you've got a noticeable shortness of breath even when you're at rest. Number nine, you're feeling more tired and weakened overall. Number 10, you have dramatic weight loss and clothes are noticeably looser. So that is the checklist of signs for being allowed into a palliative care situation and then ultimately a hospice situation. And I think that those are also the signs that he is discussing when he was just talking about just that, signs that get you into palliative care, because they're signs of dying. And each one of those is really negotiable, because I think I had 4 out of 5 of these signs last week myself. But you know, it's all objective. And then if you were to live longer than the 6 months required, you know, for that number one box to be checked off as your life expectancy, they will re-up your palliative care, so that it doesn't just end right there, because again, dying is an objective sport. It's different for everybody. So anyway, without too much more to say about that. I just wanted to read about the signs of dying there, and we'll get back on the road with Stephen Jenkinson. Enjoy.
Nobody dies that I saw, really, as a consequence of the bargain. Like things going horribly wrong on the table and like that. So people do enter into the more time, and it bears no resemblance to the more time that they were bargaining for. In what way? Well, you know, unexaminedly, the bargain for more time, you could characterize as hankering after a pre-morbid state that you remember.
Mm-hmm.
Right? More energy, more time with the children or the grandchildren or the dog, mm-hmm. or maybe all of them at once, or all of them banished from the house for a little peace or whatever it is, a little time up the mountain, down, etc. All of that. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. More often than not, some degree of it happens. Here's the quieter thing that is not said, because I don't think it's suspected even amongst the people who are delivering this service, that the more time that's granted to you will be lived in a death-phobic culture. The consequence of that is your more time will be lived in the distinct and identifiable shadow of the undefeated inevitability of your own death. You're not dying death-free. Your more time is more time because you're dying. That's what determines the whole thing. So what happens then is that you've entertained this idea that you'll just gain this quality of life that everybody's pitching you. And quality of life seems to be stand outside the shadow of dying. That would be the pitch.
Yes, yes.
The reality is, that's where it happens.
Is in the shadow.
Absolutely.
Of your dying.
This is a knowable thing, which is knowable ahead of time. Yeah. When it happens, more time includes, in addition to those other things we talked about, more time means more symptoms. Mm. Doesn't mean fewer symptoms, it means more symptoms. Mm. Over a longer period of time, it means more drugs for those symptoms and more drugs for the side effects of the first drugs. More symptoms as a consequence of the more time and more drugs for those, and just stopping because you get the... And that's the tumbleweed I'm referring to, you see. That's what your more time is also characterized by. And no one bargains for that. So I'm sitting here telling you something that's going to be fairly grim. You think you've done so already? No, this is it. I was asked easily once every 2 weeks during the entire course of the time I worked in the business for a dying person, by a dying person, for me to help them kill themselves. Mm. And they more or less meant sort of then, or at least today, or can we make an appointment for it at least? Now, your readiness to respond to that is not governed by your familiarity with the law in your jurisdiction.
Yeah.
If that's what you're going to plea at a moment like that, you shouldn't be sitting there. So you have to have some other understanding, orientation to, and be dictated to by the fact that this request, this plea, this demand by a fellow human being for you to help them kill themselves is more or less, frankly, a direct consequence of having been granted the more time that the MedTech empire granted to them. I'm not blaming MedTech. I'm saying that the people who consumed the MedTech services at the beginning of this arrangement I'm describing are as complicit in as anybody else. So if you're looking for bad guys, there's no end to them.
Right.
If you're looking for good guys, you'll be hard-pressed to find them. The whole arrangement doesn't divide up that way. The whole arrangement divides up into: are you willing to know what is there to know? Or is it so deeply inconvenient that you've banished it as a precondition for opting for the more time that you never suspected would come to this?
I can imagine, but we can't imagine what that more time, I mean, really would turn out to be. I mean, I get it, that we would expect it to be the good things instead of the decline and more decline and
or how about this? It's not just decline. It's so you take the poison, which is what it is, okay, and your hair falls out, or it doesn't, or you become incontinent, or you don't, or the various other things, or they manage that to a certain degree, and hopefully they do. And then there's a long time between the utter certain sign that your more time is becoming briefer and briefer. And it's that in-between time where nothing really seems to be happening was the time I was most frequently asked to help somebody kill themselves. Not in the grim, tearing your hair out pain in the middle of the nighttime, but in the time of where a death-phobic culture visits upon you your deepest intolerance for the realities of dying. It would be one thing if you were in the full grasp of moment by moment dragging you to the cliff edge stuff. But when it's very unspectacular, almost indistinguishable from ordinary, and yet you're dying anyway, a death phobic culture prescribes intolerance for a moment like that.
Intolerance, meaning we're not going to tolerate your thinking you're dying or that you are dying?
That's in there. No, the intolerance for the great in-between that you have landed in. You see, either I'm dying or I'm not.
Black and white.
That's the sound of intolerance. Well, am I dying? Well, yes. Well, how come I don't feel too bad? Because that's what it's like in more time land. Sometimes.
More time. Okay.
You know what one of the greatest, one of the deep nightmares for dying people was? It sounds strange to you. Having a good day. How could that possibly be? Answer is, when you're having a good day, it messes with your the choreography that you've imagined, which is that dying is just a continued spiral that's as identifiable and that's a reliable map. And the truth of dying, particularly when you're in your the more time that you bargain for, is that dying is not just amassing symptoms without end. Dying is a lot of not much happening. And that unspectacular quality of it drives people to the very cliff edge of sanity.
All right. Thank you, Pat Durkin. So we are on air with Stephen Jenkinson. We are listening to a two-part interview. And he is kind of right in the middle, so I'll get back to it. Here we go.
More often than not. So a good day becomes seductive. And oftentimes people say, well, how can I be dying and feel this good? And if I can feel this good as a consequence of what you gave me, give me some more. And the doctor's in the unenviable position of saying, more will not give you more of this. Because more of that, given how harsh and strong that stuff is, you have to pay for elsewhere in your physique, elsewhere in your metabolism, elsewhere in your digestive system, and so on. And that's what the other drugs things is for. So the grotesqueries of this arrangement include you being seduced by the idea that there's this endless arsenal of possibilities you have recourse to if you live in a large center, if you're well off, and that each one of these is just, you know, escalating in urgency, but not in consequence for you. But in truth, you know, everything costs. We could just say that. And then when you buy a little more time, the kind of peripheral consequences could be digestive. It often is. Well, then you have to take something for the fact that it's messed with your digestion because your enzymes aren't working anymore and it's knocked up this and da-da-da-da. But that thing has consequence for your capacity to generate your own saliva. So now, and you understand.
Yeah.
And this is, and then people have got shelves of stuff they have to keep track of. And of course the famous pill boxes that you see everywhere now.
That's right.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yes.
Morning, night, or 3, 6, 9, or whatever it is, you know, something.
Yeah, yeah.
And your life is on a grid of what you take. And at some point somebody starts looking bleakly through the cell bars of their circumstance, saying, but nobody told me, or I never bargained for this, or how can this be right, or something's going wrong. Or there wouldn't be all this stuff. No, because you're still sitting here, excuse me, the fact that you're still sitting here is a consequence of all that stuff on the shelf. Mm. Now, here's what it finally comes to. Either you, or more likely, your family, will be asked to agree to a withdrawal of the technology, the withdrawal of which will probably result in you dying in a rather timely fashion. The same technology that you were asked to agree to 2 months or 6 months right. ago
right.
in the name of the same thing. The love that you propose to have for this person that we're withdrawing this drug from, or this procedure from, or this apparatus from. Now, I'm telling you that it is my experience that nobody, there is no family whose way of being a family includes the capacity to make decisions like that.
That's, yeah. In this culture, you're gonna, it's like, you know, do all you can to keep my loved one alive.
Because that's what love's supposed to be.
That's right.
Keep it rolling.
How can we do this differently? We've only got a couple minutes and we'll go into part two, but just give us a taste.
The way things change is by recognizing how they are, not by wishing it was otherwise. Look, this is a grown-up scenario. Grown-ups learn. They don't wish. Grown-ups don't hope in the face of things going haywire. Grown-ups learn how it came to be as it is and the incremental decisions they made that contributed to where they now find themselves. Without that beginning, there's no beginning for it being otherwise.
Well, that's being grown up in this culture isn't why we have.
It's another problem.
I mean, sure. I mean, we have hope all over the place.
Yes,
in,
ma'am.
In this.
Mm-hmm. We have an industry of hope generation.
So starting is by being aware of these things that nobody bargained for and nobody warned you is coming.
Yeah.
I mean, the oncologist doesn't tell you that at one point these are all going to fail and we're going to withdraw them.
Probably not.
Or that everybody will keep on the happy face to say, you know, keep thinking positive, or we don't want to look at all of that. I mean,
few people do, but mostly not.
I mean, we keep death behind the door at arm's length, far away, as you mentioned in your book, pall, meaning a cover. And I realized that fits. We hand it off to the medical industry and to the funeral industry, and we don't get to watch dying very
yes,
much. Most people.
Yes, you do. Let's say it properly. Of course, you get to if you so choose.
Ah. That's different.
That's the grown-up thing I'm talking about.
Mm.
It's harder and harder to see it, yes, because the options are more and more for subtle, indiscriminate, and very discreet dying, to the point where the best possible outcome is that the nurse can write on the chart, patient resting comfortably. Let me tell you what that costs. To have that written down. I've been telling you for half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you get to patient resting comfortably. The ultimate incarnation of that is more sedation used per dying person than you would ever guess.
So, we're just sedating people so they aren't even as present as they might otherwise be.
We are sedating people because of what we did to them and with them and at their bequest, before the moment of sedation.
Mm.
Sedation is a consequence of what we do and what we don't do. It is not a consequence of dying.
Yes, I get that. Mm. I get that. Mm. It's just the next thing down
it's
the road
the next thing
that
to
we
do.
Can administer.
Yes, and you sedate people in order to what? In order to comfort them.
Yeah.
Are we really persuaded that by virtue of them being, as they call it in the business, unresponsive, that because someone is unresponsive, they're resting comfortably? I'll tell you what, I could tie you up so you couldn't move, I could bind your mouth so you couldn't speak, and we could call you unresponsive.
Yeah.
Is that resting comfortably?
Yeah.
I know I know it's a bit of a drastic comparison to make, but it's not altogether a useless comparison to make. There's a lot of parallel. Because when you're sedated, you are bound.
Yeah.
You are rendered incapable of responding. And everyone's, generally speaking, glad of that. Because that's deemed to be compassionate. But the question is, minus the sedation, what's likely to be going on? A degree of raving is not unlikely. Raving.
Raving.
Mm-hmm. Raving. Clutching at the bedclothes is a very common thing.
I'm going to pause. Okay. I'm going to pause and I'm going to pick it up. Raving. Mm-hmm. I'm Janaea Donaldson. You're watching Peak Moment. My guest is Stephen Jenkinson, the author of Die Wise. And we're talking about what it's like out there, or at least in Canada, probably the United States. Join us for part two.
Bravo.
Yep.
He's got a good point there.
Right. Really.
I kind of was lately sort of watching someone pass away, and that whole thought of the birth endorphins came to my mind.
Birth, yeah.
Birth endorphins.
Well, it is.
When you die.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a bunch of endorphins present when you die. You get the DMT dump. You get the, you know, all of those things. And my friend had gone into a coma, you know, and then, so they didn't give him any sedation. He was sedated himself. But during that time, the agitation that occurred was, yeah, he was trying to move and he was trying to get out of the bed and do things that he couldn't do or that he was unaware of, and they were that's when the sedation came in, you know,
for kind of him, like, that, yeah, that's when they sedated him.
Yeah,
and that doesn't happen to everybody. I mean, some people, like they say, die peacefully in their bed, and
mm-hmm.
some people, he had a lot of other issues. It is like birth in the sense that no two deaths are the same.
Well, yeah, right.
No two births are the same. And
I was just thinking, the body's intelligence, you know, it's got to do something. Something's got to kick in there. It's not like a completely inhumane situation or an inhumane idea to.
It's totally human. There's nothing
non-human about it.
Yeah, nothing inhumane.
That's the final point of being human.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that we knew that decades ago, and it, and then the medical profession, as he says, took over and gave us the opportunity to have more time.
Mm-hmm.
But like he said in another thing I'd heard, it's like you have more time dying.
Right.
It's not like you have more time living, because you constantly know that this time you have is just...
Well, even like health fanatics. When you ask a health fanatic, which part of your life are you prolonging? You know, you're going to live till 90 or something, right? So
yeah.
you're pushing the 85 to 90 spot, which is just when you're going to be as old as you're ever going to be, and you're prolonging your frailty.
Right.
With all that hem health.
You know? I mean, that's kind of how I see it. It's like at 80, turning 80, and it's not like it's that much fun all the time, because mm-hmm. I can't imagine when they say, oh, look at them at 80 or look at them at 90, and it's mm-hmm. like, well, let's talk to them in the morning when they get out of bed. Let's talk to them, you know.
Don't watch that AARP commercial and think that that's very realistic.
Yeah, I mean, Jenkinson to me is just, you know, kind of telling the reality of, yeah, you can do it and you get more time, but like he says it, like I said, he says, you know, more time dying. You don't get more time being alive and vibrant and, yeah, maybe you have a day or two, but...
You know, the language is really interesting once you start breaking it down like he does. you know, because you don't have that conversation. You don't begin to have a conversation like this until you have a diagnosis of something, you know.
And then do the doctors tell you, well, you'll have more time, but, you know, more chemotherapy and more whatever. I mean, it's like, in order to get that time, what's
Well, and the time is based on an average, and the average isn't based on you. It's based on everybody who's already died before you, and how long did it prolong the death, and, you know, what was it? I saw this thing, and it was, it prolongs your life by 18 months, but your diagnosis puts you in 1 to 2 years anyways. So it didn't give you 18 extra months.
My mother was diagnosed. Yeah, my mother was diagnosed with 6 months with cancer, and she lived 3 years.
Yeah,
and of course she did do a lot of really unpleasant things, I guess, to keep her. But you know, she was kept alive in bed, throwing up, not exactly, you know, enjoying life, and in the fear of dying because you've already been told you're going to die. So that doesn't, that thought doesn't go away.
No.
It's like, I don't know, it doesn't sound like fun to me. But
none of it's fun.
Right.
I wonder what his palliative care unit was like.
It was very highly medical and technical because he was in
a hospital.
In a very serious high-tech hospital.
Yeah.
But he did, I think, have an opportunity to talk to people like he's talking to us now.
Yeah.
I would imagine he doesn't, I don't think he carried on the facade of like, oh, have this treatment and then.
Right. Well, you know BJ Miller?
Yeah, yeah.
He's the best. He's just so great. But like his, the facility he works at, you know, it's not a medical facility. It's a Zen center. You know, so
tell people who he is who don't know him.
B.J. Miller is an author who wrote a very good palliative care book. He's a palliative care doctor, and he is also a triple amputee. So when he was young, he was horsing around on a subway car, and he climbed to the top of the subway car and had his arms outstretched over his head. And he was wearing a metal watch, and it hit the line on the subway car, which is an electric line that runs the subway. And it electrocuted him, and electricity came out of all four of his body parts, you know, and basically blew his arms and legs off. And so from there, he was, you know, his second year of college or something like that. So he had everything in front of him, and he had to, you know, complete those 2 years in the hospital as he was recovering from this extremely life-changing situation. And I don't think it led him directly to palliative care.
It sort of did. It led him to be a doctor.
But it was moving around in that aspect. One of the cooler things that I remember, he had a story, and he said that when he was in the hospital, it had snowed outside for the first time that year. It was the first snow, and he didn't have any windows in the room that he was staying in, but he heard that it had snowed, and a nurse brought in a snowball and gave it to him to touch and hold. And you know, he said it was the most touching thing that anybody had ever done.
To think
of that, you know, always think of that. I'm like, wow, people would love that, some sand or some water or something from in here.
Yeah, no, he's remarkable. He's written some remarkable books about dealing with real tragedies.
Yeah, so you go into his palliative care center, and it is a Buddhist-centered center, and they have all different kinds of rituals around. When someone dies, all the nurses and doctors and people line the halls as they bring the shrouded body out, you know, and everybody sort of pays attention to what's going on in there. It's not, oh gosh, shut everybody's door and gurney this person down the hall kind of thing, you know. It's really different and really cool.
Yeah,
so.
it's again, I feel like we're just going back to what was, and it's a slow process, but you know, people used to die at home.
Oh yeah.
And and everybody understood that there's a time to die, and evidently you would just take to your bed like 2 weeks before you died, not knowing you were even going to die, and mm-hmm. then, you know, it happened quick. Nobody ran to the doctor. I mean, some of the tests they give you, like Alzheimer's, I was like, who wants to know unless they can fix it? I just assume.
Right.
Wait a minute, because if they don't have a remedy.
Well, that's what I kind of keep saying. I keep saying we know too much. We know too much.
Too soon.
Too soon.
Yeah, because you start getting
You ruminate on the information. You get afraid. All of it.
Unless there's something
that you could do.
They can really do about it. I don't want to know.
Unless there's a quick surgery to fix it, I don't want to know.
I don't even want a surgery. I don't want to know.
I don't want to know
till it gets so in your face.
That you have to know.
That you do what you can do. That's what palliative care is. You do what you can do to be comfortable and accept.
Mm-hmm.
It makes much more sense. I think it makes much more sense to us, to our generation. Because my mother's generation, it was go to the doctor.
Right.
Because he'll fix you. And I saw what that looked like, and I realized, well, that doesn't work. So that's why we're here. Right mm-hmm. now, even mm-hmm. talking about what works.
Somebody asked me the other day, I guess they didn't know that I worked at the mortuary, and they said, oh my gosh, how can you work at the mortuary? And I said, well, I mean, it's to me, it feels like a woman's work when you're just caring for people, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just caring for people. Does it matter that they're not alive?
Yeah.
That they don't care about me.
And there's a lot of speculation, which we will never ever know, how long there is a certain level of consciousness still
mm-hmm.
in the body, even though you've stopped breathing.
Yeah.
Who knows how much longer will the Tibetans say?
3 to 5 days or
yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know that they know any better than anyone else, but it's an interesting question.
Well, they didn't just make it up. Somewhere someone saw something.
No, they might have made it up.
You think they just made it up?
Well, everything's made up about death because nobody could possibly know.
You know, that is a great point. Everything is made up.
About almost everything.
About almost everything.
Really. And it's made up based on your own personal DNA, so to speak. It's like everybody, what is it? There's 7 billion truths.
Oh my gosh.
Because everybody has their truth. And,
yeah. You know, truth is plural.
Yeah.
Truth is
or
plural.
Or like they say about a you know what. Everybody has one.
Right.
I don't know if you're supposed to say that.
An opinion?
Yeah. Like something else everybody else has.
Like
right?
something else that we all have.
That we can't say. Or maybe we can, but I'm too proper.